competing for legitimacy, competing for military and political power. So the U.S. has gone in on the side of that government. What's interesting is they have not even made the claim that there was an immediate threat to the United States or to American citizens. That could be used to justify an immediate presidential order. They have not tried to say, because certainly that isn't the case, there is no threat to the United States coming out of the chaos
Phyllis,
in Libya.
Phyllis, very quickly, in October of 2011, then-Secretary of State Hillary Clinton was between interviews when she was told that Muammar Gaddafi had been killed. This was her response.
Yes, we came, we saw, he died.
Did it have anything to do with your visit?
No, I'm sure it did.
That was Hillary Clinton in 2011. Your final response,
whatever else, this was not a joke. It was not a joke for the thousands of people who have died in Libya. It was not a joke for anyone. The situation in Libya is far worse now than it was. Hillary Clinton, of course, as Secretary of State then, was the leading voice urging President Obama to participate. And this kind of escalation is only going to make the situation worse. There is no military response to terrorism. President Obama says that over and over again. It's time we held him accountable to his own words, to say there is no military response. Therefore, we shouldn't use military methods against terrorism. It doesn't work.
Phyllis Bennis, thanks so much for being with us, fellow at the Institute for Policy Studies. That does it for our broadcast. Democracy Now! Is produced by Mike Burke, Sam Malkoff, Laura Gottesdiener, Carla Wills, Noreen Sheikh. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. Thanks so much for joining us.
Kibu Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of the Rock the Block Matt Dishman Community Center Block Party and Appreciation Event, Saturday, August 13th at the Matt Dishman Community Center in Portland. Activities include crafts, a rock climbing wall, inflatables, a dance party, and resource table from local agencies and businesses. Again, that's the Matt Dishman Community Center Block Party and Appreciation Event, Saturday, August 13th. At the Matt Dishman Community Center, 77 Northeast Knott Street in Portland. More information can be found at kbu.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
Come over here to the right-hand speaker.
KBOO's book and record sale is happening August 13th at Cider Riot, 807 Northeast Coot Street, starting at noon. Find treasures amongst the stacks of donated items while raising money for KBOO, your very own community radio station.
Friction between the stylus and the record produces a force which makes the arm try to swing towards the record center.
Again, that's KBOO's book and record sale, Saturday, August 13th from noon to 7 p.m. at Cider Riot, 807 Northeast Coot Street in Portland. More information can be found at kbu.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
I'm now standing in the center, and my voice should be located precisely midway between the speakers.
The time is now 5:02 p.m. You are listening to KBOO Portland. Up next is the evening news, and this KBOO program has been made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Step House Networks, offering high-speed residential and business internet services throughout the Portland area. More information about Step House internet services is available at 503-548-2000 or at stephouse.net.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, Corvallis declares a housing crisis.
The Olympics get off to a rough start before it opens.
And KBOO special reporter Stevie Elipan gives us an update from Puerto Rico.
Good evening, this is the KBOO Evening News for Tuesday, August 2nd, 2016. I'm Kane Schlesinger.
And I'm Liam Delta. The mayor of Corvallis told the city council last night that houselessness there has reached crisis proportions. The Corvallis City Council is trying to prepare shelters for houseless folks in the area by November 1st, in time for the onset of winter. Conversations on the developing homeless crisis in Corvallis will resume at the next council meeting on August 15th. In March, KEZI.com reported that homeless advocates and local clergy are pushing for a legal encampment site in Corvallis. Adding to the crisis, public water was recently turned off in Corvallis due to high concentrations of lead.
Houseless campers are no longer going to be protected under the Safe Sleep policy. Mayor Charlie Hales has reversed the policy that was originally implemented back in February of this year. The Safe Sleep pilot program was met with controversy and has caused confusion between campers and business owners as to what was permitted. The end of the Safe Sleep program comes on the heels of the announcement of a sweep of the Springwater Corridor. Although Mayor Hales has pushed back the date for the sweep, housing advocates and residents of the houseless camps continue to push for the city to provide more resources for the city's growing population of displaced people.
More than 50 farmers, or rather, more than 50 farmers' markets in Oregon will double food stamp money spent on produce this summer. The Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program, SNAP, will match up to $10 per person per visit. The program is called Double Up Food Bucks. It's funded federally through the U.S. Department of Agriculture. More than 700,000 people in Oregon receive SNAP benefits. The typical amount for an adult is up to $195 a month. That breaks down to about $6.50 a day. Just 2% of the federal budget went for food stamps in 2012, compared with 19% for defense in the same year.
A Portland man claims he was fired for racist reasons from Precision Cast Parts after 19 years of employment. The employee, Carvin Glover, who is African-American, has filed a $600,000 lawsuit against the company. Glover alleges that he was fired in March of 2015 in retaliation for complaining about a racist supervisor. Prior to being fired, Glover claims that he was referred to as the N-word and received racial slurs from fellow employees, alleging such remarks as, quote, "You can't be seen during a power outage." Precision Cast Parts has declined to comment on the matter while litigation is pending. The Portland-based company has taken over $37 billion, has been taken over for $37 billion by Warren Buffett last year.
Advocacy groups, lawmakers, even the governor are calling for reform of Oregon's gun laws. For more, here's KBOO's Tony Longshanks.
Advocacy groups, lawmakers, even the governor are calling for reform of Oregon's gun laws. The group Ceasefire Oregon, along with its sister organization in Washington, are joining with others to help create a West Coast Wall, an assault weapons ban stretching from Washington to California. Penny Okamoto, who heads Ceasefire Oregon, says the wall would amount to a regional ban, solving a problem illustrated in cities like Chicago.
It has suffered horrifically from gun violence, even though it has some really good gun laws. But the problem is that too many guns are being brought in from either other parts of the state or other states connected to Chicago.
Nearly 60% of guns recovered at crime scenes were from out of state, according to a 2014 report by Chicago law enforcement. Ceasefire Oregon stepped up its campaign to ban assault weapons after a shooting at a Clackamas mall in 2012. This month, Governor Kate Brown announced Oregonians United Against Gun Violence, outlining policy proposals for the state's legislative session in 2017. The executive order includes a ban on extended capacity magazines, which enables shooters to fire a large number of rounds before reloading. Okamoto says it would close what's known as the boyfriend loophole so that people convicted of certain domestic violence crimes no longer have access to firearms.
She has a work group set up for domestic violence, trying to see what we can do to reduce domestic violence, especially in terms of gun violence. Another thing she did was strongly urge Congress to pass an effective assault weapons ban.
According to Okamoto, even gun owners are backing her organization and the policies proposed by Brown.
The vast majority of gun owners support the actions that we do. And we know that around half of gun owners actually support an assault weapons ban. They don't understand why people would have a rifle like that.
She adds Ceasefire Oregon is planning a campaign to educate the public on the assault weapons ban and West Coast Wall. For KABU Evening News, I am Tony Longshanks.
Mountaineering has traditionally been thought of as a white male-dominated activity here in the United States. Even as the demographics of the United States are changing, diversity in the outdoors continues to be an issue. One filmmaker is aiming to shine a light on a group of 9 African-American mountaineers who scaled America's highest peak in his documentary, An American Ascent. The documentary is having its Portland premiere this Sunday at the Hollywood Theater. To learn more about this unique expedition, KABU spoke with the film's director, Andy Adkins.
So tell me about your film, American Ascent. For our listeners who don't know anything about your film, what is it about?
It's a documentary about the first ever all-black team of mountain climbers to attempt a big summit. Like, in this case, it was Denali, the mountain formerly known as McKinley, for you out there who know the history of the mountain. And it was the first time that a group like this had come together, and it was for the purpose of bringing attention to the fact that there's not a lot of diversity in outdoor sports right now, but also to attention to the stories of people of color who are out there doing this, because it's not as if there's no people of color in the mountains. It's just that they're pretty underrepresented. And so that was the point of the project. The project was called Expedition Denali, and it was a project of the National Outdoor Leadership School. And that was what we filmed. That was the expedition that we filmed a few years back.
This group of 9 climbers, the mountaineers that mm-hmm. went up to Denali, did they already know each other? How did they come together as a group?
Well, Knowles brought them together. They had all taken Knowles courses, so they're alumni of Knowles. And they had known each other from some team building stuff that Knowles had brought them to over the, I want to say, maybe 6 to 12 months prior to the expedition. They had done another climb like the summer before. They did a climb of Mount Baker up in Washington, and a few other team building events where they all got together. Some of them knew each other from previous lives or from Knowles courses, but a lot of them didn't. There was 9 of them, and they didn't all. It wasn't as if they were a big tight group to begin with, but they did obviously get to know each other pretty well through the course of this whole expedition and the sort of the pre and post events.
So what has been the response to your film?
It's been amazing. I mean, I have to say we've been super, super happy with how it's been received. It played at a White House event last summer. That was a pretty critical moment that we were super proud of. It's played at a lot of African-American film festivals around the country and won quite a few awards. And at this point, you know, thousands of people have seen it. And it's really, we really feel like it's reaching the audience that we intended it to reach, which is like mostly kids of color in cities that don't usually get exposed to this type of story. And so, yeah, the response has been great. I mean, I have to say it's in a way we couldn't be happier with how well it's been received. I've attended a lot of the screenings, and the feedback afterwards and the discussions afterwards are just great. And it's you know, for the most part, exactly where we wanted it to go.
And have you gotten much feedback from other people of color who are in the outdoor industry? Is exciting for them to see some representation finally on in the media?
Yeah, for sure. Yeah, again, it's just been phenomenal, the response, and particularly from people of color, communities of color. I think in a weird way, it's actually done a lot better there than like in the outdoor adventure community, which, again, predominantly white. And that surprised us a little bit, but it does make sense in a way. Like, it's a mountain climbing movie, but there's lots of mountain climbing movies, right? And so it's in sort of competing with other films that come out every year about climbing big mountains. But there's not much out there right now about African Americans or people of color taking on these mountains. And so I guess it's no real big surprise that it's really resonated in those communities mostly, but it definitely has been a little lopsided. I guess we weren't expecting it to be quite so lopsided, like a ton of excitement in communities of color, not so much in the sort of general mountaineering community, I would say, but, you know, still definitely people are into it. And I think almost everybody that we've talked to appreciates and values the kind of movement to diversify the outdoors.
So we're on radio, so our listeners can't see you. So
right.
I can put it out there, just say that you are a white man.
Yes, I am not a person of color.
And so why did you personally find this to be a compelling project to be part of? Why did you find it important to tell this story?
Yeah, that's a really good question. And we, you know, this is something that we had to sort of come to terms with right away, is like, are we the best people to tell this story? It's because George Potter, the other guy, is Australian, white Australian. And you know, so, it's like, I think the best person to tell the story is often the person who's kind of right there and closest to it, and that was us at the time. However, you know, we both spent a lot of times outdoors, and I was living in Bozeman, Montana at the time. He's still there. That's where this film began. And, you know, we were skiers, snowboarders, outdoor enthusiasts. I grew up hiking, going camping with my parents in the Northwest here. And it was kind of one of those things that we just... After talking with the climbers, it's like it's something you kind of always knew was there. Like you're outdoors, you're hiking in the Cascades or whatever, and yeah, it's a very white. At least back when I was a kid, and it's gotten a little bit more diverse, but back then it was extremely white. And I guess coming to terms with that, like really quickly when we met all these climbers and having that, it was almost like an aha moment. Like, oh yeah, this is an issue I've always kind of known was there, but, it really kind of came into stark relief right at that moment. And I thought, yeah, I kind of get it. Like, I don't get it as in I have experienced anything like this, but you know, I understand why this is important and it really needs to be told. And I think there's also something to be said here for the changing demographics of the country, as we shift to a minority-majority nation. We can't have the same demographics enjoying the outdoors, or we can't have the same proportion of demographics enjoying the outdoors into the future and still expect the outdoors to be a place that the majority of Americans value and want to protect and want to fight for. So that's part of it, too. I always sort of saw the mission of this as sort of threefold. Like, getting people of color outdoors is good for lots of reasons for those communities and those people. Like, it's healthy, as you know. It's for your mental health, your physical health, to get outdoors. So it's good for those people in those communities. It's good for the protection of the environment, because if you're not out there experiencing it, you're not gonna appreciate it, you're not going to love it, and you're not going to want to protect it. And then the third thing is it's pretty good for industry. Like, it's good for, and when I say industry, I mean the outdoor industry, which is actually a pretty big industry in this country, between all the clothing and apparel and gear out there. That was kind of sort of the third, like, probably less important, but the third element of this that kind of resonated.
Now, I know you can't possibly speak for all nine of the mountaineers that were in this film, but just real quick, because I know we're running out of time here, what has been their response to seeing how many people have viewed this and just seeing themselves there on the screen? Was that a powerful thing for them?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, there was a couple climbers in the film that at the time were just like barely in their 20s. So there was some pretty young kids up on the mountain with us. And it was amazing to watch them sort of see themselves in this story that maybe, you know, 4 or 5 years ago, they never would have imagined that they would be on this mountain and then subsequently in this film. That's been really cool. The other thing I was going to say is that it's been really neat to have the film become sort of a vehicle to extend the mission of Expedition Denali, because it's still going on, but it's mostly ran its course after the climb. For about a year, they were touring around and giving talks and stuff, but the film has really kept going and it's still being played all over the country. And it's really cool to have that continue. And, you know, we'll have climbers come and give guest appearances. We're actually going to have on Sunday, the screening at the Holly, we're going to have Adina Scott, who was on the expedition with us. She's going to be there.
Well, actually, you just beat me to that. Yeah. So, we didn't talk about that yet. The reason I'm talking to you is on Sunday.
Yeah.
Sunday, your film is premiering here in Portland at the Hollywood Theater at 7 p.m. And there's still tickets available?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, definitely. There's, it's the Portland premiere. I'm going to be there with another one of the expedition cinematographers, Hudson Henry, who's also based in Portland. And we're going to have Adina Scott who's one of the nine climbers on the team with us. We're going to be sort of doing just a Q&A, a little discussion afterwards. Yeah, there's definitely tickets still available. You can get them at the Hollywood Theater website. You can get them at the box office. You can check out our website, AmericanAscent.com, and sort of find your way to get tickets there. So, yeah, definitely love to see all of you out there on Sunday. It's going to be great.
Okay, well, we're just about out of time here. So thank you very much, Annie Adkins, for joining me. That was Annie Adkins, director and producer of the documentary film An American Ascent, which is having its Portland premiere this Sunday, August 7th at 7 p.m. at the Hollywood Theater. So to learn more, go to Go to www.anamericanascent.com or find them on Facebook and Twitter at An American Ascent. For the KBOO News, I'm Jenny Yokoyama. Thanks for joining me.
Thanks.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned for News in Depth at 5:45, followed by Trans Positive at 6. At 7, Hard Knock Radio, news, views, and hip-hop. Tomorrow's weather, sunny with some morning clouds and a high of 81. East of the Cascades and Hood River, a slight chance of showers, but mainly clear skies with a high of 86. Today in history, German President Paul von Hindenburg died, and Adolf Hitler became chancellor. In 1935, and the quote of the day is from Hitler, "He alone who owns the youth gains the future."
It's 5:21. Time for a daily commentary from Jim Hightower.
What if progressive organizers and volunteers join forces to run a nationwide campaign to replace today's corporate-owned Congress all at once? Yes, one sweeping campaign against all incumbents of either party who owe their jobs to the big money powers. The idea is to oust these Congress critters with hundreds of coordinated brand-new Congress campaigns running simultaneously in every state, backing local candidates publicly pledged to fight for an agenda of economic, social, environmental, and political justice. Impossible? Not in the minds of several former Bernie Sanders staffers who conceived and implemented his campaign's successful grassroots model. They trained and empowered tens of thousands of far-flung volunteers to be autonomous organizers, digitally linked into a nationwide network, eliminating the need and cost of a rigid hierarchy of leaders to boss volunteers, recognizing instead that volunteers are already leaders. Now, they're applying this model to an effort called Brand New Congress, which will carry the message of authentic populism and a shared agenda of populist policy proposals. It's to be a true bipartisan effort, running Dems in blue districts, Repubs in solid red ones, and Independents wherever that makes sense. But wait, how can they get Republican candidates to run on progressive values? By recognizing that true populism is neither a right or left theory, but a top versus bottom reality that even middle class and lower income Republicans can relate to. Indeed, outside of the right-wing Congress, many rank-and-file Republicans are for stopping global trade scams and repealing Citizens United, as well as for assuring health care for all, recognizing climate change, and standing up to bigotry. This is Jim Hightower saying, to stay in the loop and get involved, go to www.brandnewcongress.org. Brandnewcongress.org.
Hightower's commentaries are brought to you by the Hightower Lowdown, the monthly newsletter with Hightower's take on what Wall Street and Washington are up to. For information, visit HightowerLowdown.org.
Copies of the U.S. Constitution have been selling like hotcakes since the father of a fallen Muslim soldier flashed his copy at Donald Trump during the Democratic Convention last week. But if you're feeling the patriotic duty to acquire a copy of your own, you should check the fine print before you buy. Here's the dirt on the U.S. current best-selling Constitution.
In a powerful speech last week at the Democratic National Convention, patriotic military parent Khizr Khan offered to lend a copy of his pocket constitution to Republican Muslim basher Donald Trump. Now, outlets such as PBS are reporting that pocket constitutions are topping Amazon's bestseller lists. But this heartwarming story comes with a twist. The best-selling constitutions are actually heavily annotated by an extreme right-wing religious fundamentalist praised by the likes of Ammon Bundy and Glenn Beck. The author, Cleon Skousen, became a Tea Party hero after his death in 2006. Skousen's ramblings helped him rise from an unknown, communist-hating, Mormon, Bible-loving radical to briefly serving as Salt Lake City's police chief. Militant leader of the Malheur Wildlife Refuge anti-government takeover, Ammon Bundy, said of Skousen's constitution, "That's where I get most of my information from." Visitors to Amazon's listing for the annotated constitution will find it has 81% five-star ratings. Amazon's official description makes no mention of the annotations or their radical author. Instead, Amazon says it is proofed word for word against the original Constitution and is identical in every spelling and punctuation. But visitors who look more deeply will see the most popular reviews give the title the lowest rating because it is filled with the ramblings of a Bible-thumping zealot. Huge media outlets like the Washington Post, the AP, and PBS have noted the surging sales of this version of the Constitution, but only online media outlet The Intercept mentioned the extra notation. Amazon CEO and Washington Post owner Jeff Bezos, who is set to open the company's third brick-and-mortar store in Portland's Washington Square Mall, has not commented. For those inspired to own a copy of the U.S.'s founding document without notes from a Mormon Tea Party fanatic, the ACLU is offering copies for free. This is Emery Mort with KBOO News.
And now we hear the latest in worker-related news from our friends at laborradio.org.
You're listening to WIN, Workers Independent News, a production of Diversified Media Enterprises. I'm Doug Cunningham.
Democrats, get on your feet! Let's change the rules! Let's take back Congress! Let's win a pro-worker Supreme Court! And let's elect Hillary Clinton, the next president of the United States!
AFL-CIO President Rich Trumka in remarks from the DNC stage in Philadelphia. With Hillary Clinton on a post-convention jobs campaign bus tour, workers and their unions are busy now reaching out to as many voters as possible. Trumka says while Trump outsources jobs to make products he sells, supports anti-union laws, and wants the minimum wage to be lower, Clinton wants higher wages for workers and actually has a plan to create millions of jobs.
In this election, she's fighting to rewrite the economic rules for all of us. She has a bold plan to invest in manufacturing, infrastructure, and jobs. She opposes the job-killing Trans-Pacific Partnership. She'll protect workplace rights, stand up to Wall Street, and fight to finally, finally secure equal pay for equal work.
SEIU President Mary Kay Henry says if you make less than $15 an hour, and 64 million American workers do, then Hillary Clinton is the only major party candidate that wants to raise your pay. Henry says workers, arm-in-arm with worker-friendly political leaders, can both raise wages and protect worker rights to organize.
We are going to work together to elect champions on our issues up and down the ballot, like Hillary Clinton and like Katie McGinty for U.S. Senate here in Pennsylvania. We know that these elected champions are going to work arm in arm with the fearlessness and courage of individual working people that are joining together to raise wages and to insist that working people should be able to unite in organizations once and for all.
The Culinary Workers Union is still waiting for Trump Hotel Las Vegas to begin labor negotiations so workers can have fair wages, job security, and good health benefits. The NLRB has denied the Trump Hotel Las Vegas' final appeal against the union, so the hotel is legally required now to bargain with the culinary and bartenders' unions. The culinary workers are requesting bargaining dates, but so far, Trump Hotel Las Vegas management has not agreed to begin bargaining. The workers voted for the union months ago, but management at the hotel challenged the election. It was part of an aggressive anti-union campaign waged against the workers by Trump's company.
Brought to you by the Alliance for American Manufacturing, working to prevent the loss of American jobs caused by unfair foreign competition, and working to promote fair trade laws to level the playing field for American workers. Information on how you can help create smart, worker-focused public policy is online at AmericanManufacturing.org.
You've been listening to WIND, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit LaborRadio.org.
The 2016 Rio Olympic Games officially start with Friday's opening ceremonies, and preliminary competition kicks off tomorrow with women's soccer games. But doping, politics, and Zika continue to garner headlines for the flashy global celebration of sport, nationalism, and corporate sponsorship. The biggest Zika news comes from the U.S., where the Centers for Disease Control issued its first ever warning to U.S. residents to avoid an area due to infectious disease. The warning urges pregnant women to avoid traveling to a small neighborhood near Miami. Some athletes have backed out of the game, citing Zika, but more have spoken out about polluted water and unfinished housing accommodations. On the politics front, host nation Brazil is currently undergoing an increasingly fraudulent political coup, which has led to the overthrow of center-left President Dilma Rousseff. Newly installed interim president Michel Temer is extremely unpopular with the electorate and faces serious charges of corruption. But like the Olympics, he's very friendly to big money. But at least the Olympic competition will be pure, the athletes and coaches valorous with their colorful medals. Or maybe not. Recently, the Olympic Committee decided not to ban the entire Russian squad, even though evidence reveals state-run doping programs. Individual sporting federations have been left to decide if they want to ban Russia. So far, sports like track and field and weightlifting have banned Putin's sporting powerhouse from competing. Meanwhile, blood samples from previous Olympics are still being retested, showing dozens more athletes were using banned drugs and steroids. But those athletes' names won't be released until after this Olympics. The World Anti-Doping Agency and International Olympic Committee are trading blame in the media as more medals from previous Olympics will be taken away and given to other athletes. So for those excited to tune in to events from badminton to equestrian to marathon, best of luck staying optimistic about the athletes crying on the medal stand.
Over 100 people have died in Nepal due to floods and landslides since last Monday, July 25th. Monsoon rains have caused rivers to overflow, putting an estimated 6,000 people at risk in 43 districts of the nation of Nepal. The Nepalese army and police are said to be busy evacuating people, while at least 22 persons are missing. Photos show whole villages decimated by the chain of natural disasters, which is still ongoing. In other news from Nepal, six Nepalese were injured in a clash between Nepali and Indian sides over dam construction last week. Tensions have run high recently between both sides, as India has been accused of building a dam that encroaches on Nepalese territory and the Saptari district.
The world has lost a true humanitarian. Abdul Satin Eddy, known as Pakistan's Angel of Mercy, passed away at the age of 88 on July 8th. The Huffington Post once declared that Eddy may be the world's greatest humanitarian. In 1951, Eddy founded the Eddy Foundation by begging in the streets. At the age of 19, Eddy opened the Welfare Center in a single room in Karachi, Pakistan. This eventually grew as the Eddy Foundation to over 300 centers. Today, the foundation provides emergency assistance, homeless shelters, drug rehab, and aid and shelter to orphans. Abdul Sattar Eddy never took a salary from the foundation. There's now an online petition to nominate him for the Nobel Peace Prize.
Protesters at UBS headquarters blocked the entrance of the Swiss bank's local headquarters at 8 a.m. in Hato Rey, Puerto Rico. UBS is one of a few financial institutions responsible for accelerating the financial crisis in Puerto Rico. The Swiss bank had sold off many of the bond funds, causing what is said to be $900 million in damages. Protesters aimed to bring attention to UBS and its practices on the island by disrupting access and operations while informing the public of said practices. UBS has also been known for destroying records of orphaned assets of missing or deceased victims of the Holocaust and is mentioned in the Panama Papers. KBOO's Stevie Elipan brings us this special report from Puerto Rico.
We're at the headquarters of UPS in San Juan, Puerto Rico, where protesters are currently blocking the door. We're with Almado Martinez Lebron. Almado, why are you here blocking UPS today?
We are about to start a government of dictatorship. We are in front of UBS doing a civil disobedience because we think that we are sure that UBS is part of our debt crisis, and because of a lot of debt that have been managed by this Swiss bank, we are right now in a serious situation, and in terms of being governed by a control board that's coming from the United States to UBS. UBS is one of the responsibles of our crisis. It's one of the been dealing with the bonus packages around the world, and it's because of this management, this fraudulent management of debt, that we are right now in this crisis in Puerto Rico. So that's why we are here, trying to make everybody know that UBS is responsible of a very important part of our debt crisis. So that's the reason why we are here.
How long do you plan on staying here?
We're doing this like some kind of way to make everybody know that UBS is responsible of this situation that Puerto Rico is trying to deal with. I don't know, we might be here as long as we can, and we're gonna be doing this frequently. We're gonna be doing this in other places like banks and Popular Inc., for example, that is one of the main characters in terms of our political and financial crisis. So we're gonna be acting politically and doing activism around these important characters of our situation. It's not the first one, it's not gonna be the last one.
All right, right on, brother. Thank you very much. Hang in there.
From Hato Rey, Puerto Rico, that was KBOO special reporter Stevie Elipan.
Now it's time for a community rights commentary from Paul Cienfuegos.
Greetings, you're listening to the weekly commentary by yours truly, Paul Cienfuegos. I'm happy to be back in my weekly commentary slot on the Tuesday KBOO Evening News after 2 weeks of amazing Pacifica Radio convention coverage that preempted the evening news. And what a 2 weeks of politics it turned out to be. Wow. But that's for another day. On July 24th, I went to McMenamin's Edgefield outside of Portland to attend a Willie Nelson concert. I've been yearning to hear Willie Nelson live my entire adult life. So this was a very big deal for me, to finally be in the audience witnessing this living legend on stage in a beautiful, grassy amphitheater. I went alone, so I was able to squeeze my small blanket and festival chair in among the larger groups of people with their enormous blankets. I loved the concert, every moment of it, but what ended up surprising me quite a lot was my witnessing of we the people, thousands of us, interacting ever so awkwardly and dysfunctionally with each other, hour after hour, which is the focus of today's commentary, people watching at a Willie Nelson concert. One of the first things that I noticed is that the couples sitting on both sides of me seemed incapable or unwilling to even acknowledge my presence, which I found very perplexing indeed. In moments like this, I tend to ask myself whether such strange social behavior is universal in other societies and cultures, or whether there's something universally broken about our own modern capitalist and hierarchically structured society that rewards rugged individualist behavior over communitarian behavior. And all across the concert lawn, there were huge blankets with just two people sitting on most of them, keeping everyone else out. So much unfairness in the way that people locked up their spots, just like our addiction to our private properties where each of us lives, if we're lucky enough to have a home. The only thing that seemed to bring my concert neighbors together on the lawn was a sense of mutual outrage against a fellow sitting a few rows behind me, who came up to near where I was sitting and very kindly asked two men to sit down as they were entirely blocking his view of Willie Nelson. The two men responded with a surprising amount of hostility and contempt,
and then people all around them joined in, as if many of them had also been directly attacked. An almost gang-like sense of behavior quickly formed, in full solidarity with each other, from a place of outrage. And all of them now targeting a fellow who had simply made a request, with appropriate words and tone, and who himself was now outraged at their response. What a mess. This brought me to imagining how things might have unfolded differently if the vast majority of the crowd had some training in nonviolent communication, a profound and paradigm-shifting communication process invented by Marshall Rosenberg many years ago. How, I wondered, could this conflict have been resolved peacefully? I may be overgeneralizing, or maybe I'm not, when I make the following observation. We the people do not trust we the people. And what a huge tragedy that is, and what a huge disaster for our future together as a nation. Willie Nelson sang one classic song after another in quick succession, and unlike most famous musicians, he actively worked the crowd, attempting over and over to get us to sing along on the choruses, to really sing, loudly, together. Me, I loved that. I'm an a cappella singer. So I belted it out, but as I looked around me, I realized that very few other people were singing back to him at all. And this also troubled me and brought up curiosity about whether we the people may no longer even be capable of truly engaging a beloved performer. Yes, I'm overgeneralizing terribly here, but the fact is that a large percentage of the audience wasn't even listening to Willie, let alone singing back to him. So when Willie Nelson suddenly said goodnight to all of us, after just 1 hour of performing with no encore at all, I had to wonder whether we Portlanders had insulted him. Was he mad at us? Had he written us off as just a bunch of white, privileged, intoxicated partygoers who really couldn't care less who was on stage? It's true, most of us were not singing or clapping along, even though he had requested repeatedly that we do so. Finally, the audience started paying attention, but now it was too late. Each of them had paid $60 or more for the show, and now it was suddenly over, with no second set and no encore. That certainly got people's attention, and they didn't like it at all. I personally felt embarrassed, even though I knew that I was making just a wild guess as to why he had ended the evening so prematurely. I went online to see if I could find an explanation, but found nothing to help me make sense of what had unfolded. How did we the people become so disinterested in a true people's hero? How did we end up with such short attention spans and so little tolerance or patience for others who might have differing needs? And most importantly, what must we do to turn our culture around so that we Americans actually start to witness ourselves and each other as we the people? We have no time to lose. You've been listening to the weekly commentary by yours truly, Paul Cienfuegos. You can hear future commentaries every Tuesday on the KBOO Evening News in Portland, Oregon, and on a growing number of other radio stations. I welcome your feedback. You can subscribe to my weekly podcast via iTunes or at communityrightspdx.org. You can sign up for my community rights updates at paulcienfuegos.com. You can follow me on Twitter at cienfuegospaul. Thanks for listening, and remember, we are the people we've been waiting for.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call us with your breaking news stories at 503-231-8032. Our production team for tonight's newscast is Tony Longshanks and Emery Mort. The producer is Jenna Yokoyama. Special thanks to Labor Radio. Our engineer is Wesley Seway. The KBOO Evening News and Public Affairs Director is Lisa Loving. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You can also find us on Facebook and Twitter at KBOO News. You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Kanan Schlesinger.
And I'm Liam Delta. Coming up tomorrow morning on KBOO at 7, Democracy Now! With Amy Goodman and Juan Gonzalez. At 8 on Wednesday Talk Radio, Paul Rowland speaks with Guy McPherson, ecologist and evolutionary biologist. He coined the term near-term human extinction, saying that the human species could go extinct as soon as 2030 due to habitat loss and rapidly accelerating global warming. At 9 on Political Perspectives, Dave Mazza talks with former Seattle Police Chief Norm Stamper about his latest book, Protect and Serve: How to Fix America's Police. Stamper gives an insider look at how racism and violence is perpetuated in cop culture. At 10, Air Cascadia is off. We'll hear Flashpoints, investigative news radio with Dennis Bernstein. And at 11 on The Bike Show, a discussion about the ins and outs of proper bike etiquette with bike blog legend Bike Snob, a.k.a. Evan Weiss, and our local law aficionados, Charlie G. and Mark Ginsburg. Thank you, KBOO members, for your generous support. And if you're not a current member, you can become one by going to kboo.fm and clicking on Donate. Now stay tuned for news in depth, followed by Transpositive at 6.
KBOO News in Depth, where we take a deeper look at the top news stories impacting our community.
I'm Chris Andre, KBOO Evening News, KBOO Portland. I was speaking with Syed Benoura of the International Middle East Media Center, and he has got Ashraf Abu Rahma there. We're speaking with Ashraf, also abducted by the Israeli military last Friday, I believe. And he was almost without a doubt targeted for abduction. Can you talk about that?
So this is I was abducted during the weekly nonviolent protest against the wall in Balayin. Our protests are always nonviolent. مشاركين عادة بيكون في إسرائيليين وأجانب. And those protests are held also in participation with many international and Israeli